Captain Featherston dealt real 10. Now, what's the next thing that happens? What's your next posting and promotion?
Well, I luckily got promoted to the captain out in South Africa in December 61. And so I came home and was relieved by somebody out there. And first of all, I was told to go and stand by HMS Maidstone, which was a 12,000-ton submarine depot ship, which had just gone through a modernization to equip it to look after Polaris submarines. And she was at Portsmouth, so I joined her and did her trials in and out of Portsmouth, and then took her up to the Gairloch, where the I was to turn over to Captain Troop, afterwards Vice Admiral Sir Anthony Troop, who was in command of the Adamant, a submarine depot ship up there. So I exchanged the Maidstone for the Adamant, brought her down to Devonport. She was even bigger than Maidstone. And I then turned Adamant over to Admiral McIntosh, or Captain McIntosh as he was in those days, took over the Forth and brought her around the south of England and into Chatham to be modernized in the same way as the Maidstone. So there were all the three submarine depot ships were commanded by me in succession. But it was the first ship I'd ever had command of. And it's quite sort of quite a nervous business taking a thing that size around England. But touch wood, we had no troubles, and got them all safely into port, which is the main thing.
And then you got a ship for a little. Then you went to shape, didn't you? Sorry, August 62 to March 64. You seem to be naval deputy to the UK National Military Representative to SHAPE in Paris. Can you tell us a bit about this appointment? That sounds quite high level again.
Well, it was quite high level, yes. Each nation of NATO had a National Military Representative who would be of Air Commodore, Rear Admiral, that sort of rank. And he had a number of deputies. My boss was the United Kingdom National Military Representative, who was an Air Commodore called Bert Andrews, B-U-R-T hyphen Andrews, who was a brilliant linguist. And there was, in the outer office, it was me as his naval deputy, and a soldier, a colonel, who is his military deputy. Each nation had a setup like that in its own offices, and dealt, in my case, direct with the First Sea Lord. In the case of my boss, directly with the Chief of Defence Staff. So I was dealing with fairly high-level stuff.
Now, this was to SHAPE. Could you tell me what
Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, which is the most enormous complex, about 10 miles out of Paris, along the Autoroute du West. And we had a nice little house about 10 minutes' drive from SHAPE.
Now, so what were you dealing with? What was this that you can tell us about? What were the issues that came before you?
Before going out to SHAPE, I called on the First Sea Lord, who at that time was Admiral Sir Caspar John. And he said to me, well, Dilk, I'm told I've got to send a captain out to SHAPE. You'll find it extremely boring and very frustrating. But France is a fine country, so make sure you enjoy yourself. And with that fair wind, my wife and I sailed for France.
Now, what were you meant to be doing?
I was meant to represent back to England what the other nations of SHAPE were doing and thinking. That was really it.
And what kind of major topics were under review at the time?
It wasn't, so far as I was concerned, the immense amount to do as the first Theodore had predicted. But I do remember there was a big panic in the whole shape when the matter of Cuba came up. Friend Castro and the Americans went absolutely bananas over this. We didn't really quite understand why they were so worried. But for a time, the place did seem to hum with the rumors of this and that and what the Americans were going to do or not do and so on. Now, when I finally came to leave, I reckoned that Admiral John, Caspar John, had got it absolutely right. So I turned over my job in my house and happily came back to England with my children, speaking rather better French than I had to when I first arrived.
Now, so your next posting was to HMS St. Vincent at Gosport, which is a shore station?
Yeah.
And you were in command of this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was the role of HMS St. Vincent?
HMS St. Vincent was a primary training establishment for young sailors. I had a total of some 750 16-year-olds, and I was given a year into which to turn them into sailors ready to go to the fleet. I had a staff of about 200, all very much hand-picked, and it was the most fascinating job because these boys would arrive, some of them scruffy, some of them streetwise, some of them not very clever, and within a matter of months, almost sometimes of weeks, they were turned into sailors of a sort. I remember on one occasion being told by the commander-in-chief under whom I came that I'd got to send a party of sailors, or make their own sailors, over to Amsterdam to dance a hornpipe in front of the Queen of the Netherlands. And so we trained about 40 or 50 boys to dance the hornpipe to music, and they went over. And they received the most tremendous ovation from the Dutch for performing this hornpipe, which of course was the traditional naval dance. And the Queen of the Netherlands was absolutely enchanted with it. We got a very, very good report back from the ambassador to the Netherlands, saying what a tremendous impression they'd made. And as the Metropolitan Police also sent over some sort of demonstration, I forget what it was, and my young sailors, when the police marched off, they began to whistle the tune from Z Cars, which you may remember, and the police thought this was absolutely super, and picked up the beat and marched off to the whistled tune of Z Cars. Went down very well. They never let me down, ever, those young sailors. I suppose it was very largely due to the excellence of the instructors there, who whipped these boys into shape. But I used to assemble the boys and their parents when the class joined, about 60 boys, and tell them what my sort of philosophy was. I said I was allowed to beat boys, or to order them to be beaten, thrashed. And I used to tell them and their parents that I will beat their boys for two offences. One is for stealing from their messmates and bullying. In the whole of my time there, I never had any reports of bullying. And I only had one case of a sailor who stole from his messmates. And I punished him, but it turned out, in fact, that he was a kleptomaniac. And so I discharged him from the Navy, because the worst thing in any ship is to have a thief. The whole morale and tone of a ship goes down if you've got somebody who steals from your shipmates.
So you sounds like you had an enjoyment of this training role.
Immensely. The rewarding part was seeing these callow youths come in, long-haired, scruffy, rather pimply, unsure of themselves, and then to see them go out a year later, ready to the fleet. And they were the young men who became the technical ratings at the time of the Falkland Islands war. So it was very rewarding. I had a Royal Marines band, and the boys had a bugle band. And on Sunday divisions, which was the big annual, big weekly parade, they joined up together. So you had 80 musicians. And when they came onto the parade ground, all blaring hard, it was the most stirring sight. It was really quite astonishing how quickly they got into the naval ways. Of course, I had, as I mentioned, the most splendid officers and petty officers, instructors. I was never let down, ever, by anything. One strange thing was the apparent total lack of any homosexuality. I think probably because they were so hard worked and chased around that they were too exhausted to think of anything else but bed at the end of the day. But we never had any suggestion of it, which is rather interesting when you think of things today.
Now, unless there's anything else about HMS St. Vincent, your last naval thing was as Deputy Director of Defence Plans, Navy, at the Ministry of Defence from September 66 to September 68.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did you got that posting, and what put you there? I mean, was that just the next thing, or?
Well, I went to the Admiralty just before I finished at St. Vincent to see what my next appointment was going to be. And I saw the first Sea Lord, the second Sea Lord in person. And he said to me, if you want to get promoted to Admiral Felsen Duke, you've got to do a stint in the Ministry of Defence. So I thought, very good, sir, that's what you will say. I'd done the other necessary things. I commanded a ship, I'd been on a big staff ashore. So I said, okay, I'll go and do the Ministry of Defence. So I did that 2 years. Both my predecessor and my successor were promoted to Admiral. But I had to leave the Navy, unfortunately, because my old father died at the age of 92, and I had a large landed estate to have to look after.
We will come to that.
Now, yeah.
Tell me, what was your job? What, you were Deputy Director of Defence Plans, brackets, Navy. Now, that sounds extraordinarily responsible. What exactly was your job?
The job involved very long hours and very much concentration. But it was very interesting in what knew what was going on in government, when saw diplomatic telegrams, reports from ambassadors and so forth. At one stage I served on a committee, for example, concerned with the withdrawal from Aden and the sort of politico-military implications of that. Dennis Healy was the Secretary of State for Defence. He was a pretty tough operator. I would call him an impressive intellectual bully. In other words, you never got by with second best with Mr. Healy. He was a very tough operator, but one used to write papers for him and for the government on any subjects which their lordships are required to be advised upon. So it was a fairly responsible job.
Would it be fair to say you don't remember now the details of the issues you were dealing with, you know, the withdrawal from East of Aden, the aircraft carrier crisis? Do you remember much about those topics now? Or?
No, I don't really. They're history, really. But really, I could say that anything in the politico-military field that came up during those 2 years that I was in the MOD would have passed across my desk in one form or another, either to write a report on it or to give a view.
Now, anything else about your time there before we come to your your decision to retire?
By the time I was due to leave the Ministry of Defence in the normal course, my father was 92 years of age, and he'd been a doctor for most of his active life, and he was a very tough old bird. He got slightly ill at one stage and was taken off to hospital in Birmingham. And he returned about 2 days later, totally cured, because for the first time in his life he'd been treated by antibiotics, which hadn't been invented, of course, when he was a doctor. But nonetheless, he'd had a full life indeed. He'd been a magistrate, chairman of the mayor of Leamington Spa twice, and a highly respected figure in the county. But he came to the end of his natural life, and he died quietly in his own bed in his own home at age 92, as he said he always wished to. So that was fine. It was rather interesting. We had a coloured nurse look after him at one stage, and he was in and out of a coma on occasions in his last few days, and he woke up at one stage and saw this coloured nurse and began to address her in fluent Hausa, which is the language spoken in northern Nigeria, which he'd last spoken 40 years previously. Unfortunately, the nurse who came from Jamaica hadn't got a clue what he was talking about. But he immediately had a flashback to some black girl in the hospital in Nigeria. Sort of strange, isn't it?
And so he died in 68?
He died in 68, in the middle of January. There was snow on the ground. And my mother survived him by 9 months. So I was faced with the inheritance of a 14th century castle in not very good nick, and a landed estate of several thousand acres, farms mainly, tenanted farms. Well, they wanted to send me out either as Commodore Hong Kong or in command of forces in the Gulf. I couldn't have done either and dealt with the desk duties and things like that, which always assail one when you inherit a large landed estate. And so I went along to the Second Sea Lord and said, look, I'm sorry, I just have to go, which was tough because I might well have reached flag rank, which would be nice, but there it was. And so I wrote formally to the Admiralty and they approved my voluntary retirement. And so I eventually walked out of the Ministry of Defence in a bowler hat as a captain on the retired list of the Royal Navy.
Now, just to sort of finish the recording, could you just summarise your post-service career? You know, because you've done a fair amount of things since then, but could you just give us an idea of some of the things you've done?
I was very soon snapped up to become a Justice of the Peace. I suppose they thought that if I'd been dealing with discipline amongst sailors, I must be a natural to be a Justice of the Peace. Anyway, I think it was one of my neighbours who was a JP, put my name forward, and I was duly appointed by the Lord Chancellor. It's a great moment when you get this letter from the Lord Chancellor saying that he has in mind to appoint you a Justice of the Peace and ask you to give certain undertakings, which I did. And after a very short period of training, I found myself sitting and adjudicating on the Colesville bench, which is a local little market town. I eventually became a deputy chairman and took the chair on many occasions. I don't think we had any particularly outstandingly interesting cases. It was very largely motoring, as you can imagine. No sort of bloodthirsty murders or big thefts. Fairly run-of-the-mill stuff, but nonetheless very interesting, and every case was different, in that every defendant had some little sort of thing which you noticed and remarked on.
Now, what about your duties, well, your responsibility to run the family estate? How did you cope with
that? Well, I had a very good agent in Birmingham who had been my father's agent, and he and the lawyer, or lawyers, dealt with the matter of, and accountants, of course, these days you can't do without them, dealt with the matter of death duties, which were about a million. And so I had to raise a million, which, of course, I had to do by selling off some of the farms. That was a painful business because some of those farms had been tenanted by, you know, tenants of the estate for generations. But there it was. And so the outlying farms, by and large, were sold off. Although the Maxtick estate, which is where we're sitting now, it was kept intact. That was the main difficulty, the death duties. And you have eight years in which to pay them. And I took the full 8 years. because one doesn't want to have too many forced sails, so I took the maximum time allowed. At the same time, my wife and I embarked on a restoration and modernization of the castle, which took 9 years. We re-roofed it, re-windowed it, put in central heating, rewired it, in fact, re-everything did virtually, and put it into a state in which it could be lived in the 20th century, without anything in any way destroying its medieval appearance or general character. All done by local craftsmen and local electricians, and it cost a lot of money and it took 9 years, but it's been very well worth it, and my son now has got it as his family home, and he looks after it even better than I did.
And any other responsibilities?
I was also prevailed upon to stand against my local bank manager as a county councillor. He apparently, he should be nameless, but he was beginning to show rather dangerous liberal tendencies, I was told. Anyway, I stood against him and beat him by 2-1, which was quite satisfactory, and I then served on the county council, of which eventually I was elected chairman, and served as chairman for 2 years. I forget what it was, but in the 1980s sort of time.
Did you enjoy it?
Immensely. A lot of nice people. The Conservatives luckily were in power, but we had a very vociferous Labour opposition. But it was interesting, and I never had any sort of worries about personal relations with anybody. Very high class lot of civil servants running it. Nice office in the shower hall in Warwick, and a most interesting job entirely.
And you were Lord Lieutenant?
I was High Sheriff of Warwickshire in 1974.
What does that entail?
Well, you're the Queen's Executive Officer. You're responsible for... it's an anachronism these days, but it's a great honour. And in the old days, you had to attend executions and see that the chap was properly hung. You were responsible for collecting the Queen's debts, if any. A lot of other archaic things by modern standards. But you still are responsible for the comfort and convenience of Her Majesty's judges when they, in the old days, attended assizes or held assizes. And even now, you're expected to entertain the judges to dinner, and a good dinner at that. No cooking port for them. My son did it very well. I wore naval uniform, which you're allowed to if you've reached a certain rank in the Navy, which I had. But my son wore court dress, looking rather like little Lord Fauntleroy, which is the alternative for civilians.
Any other roles?
I was also Vice Lord Lieutenant of Warwickshire, which is the Queen's representative in the county, or his deputy, which meant that one had to deal with the members of the royal family and other VIPs who came to Warwickshire if the Lord Lieutenant himself couldn't do it. And so I've met and entertained or looked after apparently the entire royal family, with the exception of Her Majesty the Queen herself, whom I never have done, alas. But I did that until retirement age. You have to retire at 70, I think. But I'm still a deputy lieutenant and could be called upon in theory to go and do some job on behalf of the Lord Lieutenant. But I think it's unlikely now.
Thank you very much.